So just a few things. One is that my TAs have a bad exam at the end of the week, so they gave me a heads up that it's going to be probably 2 weeks before your second exam is graded. So, you know, sorry for the delay, or enjoy it. Today I have some other meetings that are going to interfere, so I'm slipping my office hours an hour from 2 to 3 today. The other thing is, rather than have a problem set due this Friday, I decided to just make it due a week from Friday. But in doing so, and to keep it sort of in sync with the rest of the class, it means it's going to be long. And I really don't advise you to just forget about it and not do anything this week, because you'll just be getting further and further behind. And it will kill you next week if you actually are trying to do it all in one week. So the due date is slipping a week, but I would actually pay it some time anyway. So anything from you guys? Okay. Okay. So just to remind you a little bit about what we were talking about last week. Similar to Gauss's law of magnetism, we have a law called Ampere's law, which, similar to Gauss's law, in its rawest form is always true, but not necessarily always useful. So, to state it, what we do is, in some region of space, if you have a closed loop, and you look at all the little differential segments around the loop, and you dot those vectors representing those little segments along the arc length of the loop into the magnetic field, if one exists in that space. When you sum it up as you go around the loop, if you integrate this B dot DL, remember, B dot DL is saying how much B is going along the direction of DL. As you integrate this around the loop, then you'll get a value which is easier times the enclosed I in the loop, which means the total current, which is topologically enclosed, is going through the loop. So all of these would be going through the loop. This one is not going through the loop. And you would indent one direction to be positive, one direction to be negative, so that if you looked at this and you wanted the net current through it, it'd be an I1 plus an I2 minus an I3, for example. Okay? So that is Ampere's law. And the main use that we'll have of it, similar to what we did with Gauss's law, where under conditions of certain symmetry, we found that we could use Gauss's law to extract the electric field. Here we'll use this relationship under conditions of certain symmetry to extract the magnetic field. In this case, usually, although you'll see in a little while, not only, but usually, how the symmetry that we'll use will be something cylindrical symmetry, because that's the symmetry you'll have often with thin wires or coaxial cables or things like that. So if you think of something that has cylindrical symmetry, and you choose a Gaussian loop to be circular and having the same axis as the axis of the symmetry of the problem. So, for example, if we have an infinite wire, which we actually did last time, and I put an Amperian loop in a plane perpendicular to the wire, circular, with a radius being the distance from the wire, and then we put our eyeball right here, and we look at it, and we see something like this. If you use your right-hand rule, you can grasp the wire in the direction that the current is going, which is coming out of the board in this perspective. And the field will circulate counterclockwise. By the symmetry of the problem, and by Biot-Savart, where it goes as 1 over r squared in terms of magnitude, we're looking at something where everything is always at the same distance. So the magnitude of B is always the same. It's circulating in a counterclockwise way. If we do Ampere's law around this loop, and we have our little DLs go around counterclockwise, then the B dot DL becomes B times DL, and the B is constant on that loop, so the B pulls out, and this is just the integral of DL, or the circumference of the circle. So we have B times 2 pi r is equal to mu 0 times I, which is the I that goes through. And so this gives us then that B is equal to mu 0 I over 2 pi R, and you're off to the races. So we did last time, I will not repeat it this time, we did a more complex example where we had a conductor with current spread going, with the current going one way, and another conductor, sort of like a shell, a cylindrical shell surrounding the first conductor where the current was going the other way. So this would be a coaxial cable. And we used Ampere's law to solve for the magnetic field in each of the regions of space in much the same way that we would do it for a cylindrical Gaussian surface in a Gaussian law problem. Okay? And so in workshop and in your problems, there'll be lots of problems we use to get used to doing things with Ampere's law. Any questions on Ampere's law in general? Okay. So, you know, as always, I'm aware that it'd be a lot of useful in terms of just doing Ampere's law to do a lot of examples for you right now. But that's really what the workshops and the problem sets are about. And so I try to, this isn't really just a problem set time and lecture. It's meant to be a bit more conceptual. So, but with apologies, I mean, you'll do those practice problems and ask questions as they come up. So I wanted to move on to sort of the magnetic equivalent of the parallel plate capacitor that we have in electromagnetism. So let's imagine that you have a bunch of wires with a current coming at you. Let's say they're just parallel wires. And let's imagine that you have an infinite sheet of these parallel wires, each of which has a current I coming out of you. So if you can imagine now what you might see, if we considered only one of these wires, and grasp the wire, our thumb in the direction of the current, we can see that the field will go in counterclockwise circles and it will drop off as 1 over r squared. So a representative magnetic field line would be something like this around that particular current, and it would be something like this around that particular current, and something like this around that one, something like this around that one. So I hope you can begin to get the idea of what's going on. Let's just pick a spot right here between these two wires. Okay? At that point, this wire is giving us a field that's going up in that direction. This wire is giving a field that goes down in that direction. Right? So if we just magnify that one point and forget the rest of the universe, let me just look here, and then let's see what field is doing. We'd have one wire giving a field like that, one wire giving a field like that. Basically, if we sort of ignore the rest of the universe, if we look at a point that's between them, the magnitudes of those fields are equal, and you can see that this component of the bottom field and this component of the top field will cancel out, and you're left only with something that's like 2 times the horizontal component. You okay with that? So if this is an infinite sheet of wires, it doesn't really matter what point I choose. I can find a symmetric piece where this kind of argument will hold true. Which basically means if I have this infinite sheet of wire, the field has no up or down component at all. If we look on top of those wires, the field will all be moving directly to the left. Okay, you see that symmetry? And on the bottom, the field will all be going to the right. There will be no up and down component. So what we'll have is basically the symmetry of the problem is that B is going this way on the top and B is going that way on the bottom. Okay? Now, if you look at the symmetry, and you know, once you realize the symmetry is there, then you can ponder whether or not you can come up with an Hamperian loop that will make use of the symmetry and allow you to calculate something. Hamperian loops are made up of B dot DLs. So remember, B dot DL, the dot product is asking what piece of the loop is going along the B field. It's zero if there's no piece of the loop, and it's just B times DL if you go directly along the field. So let us look at what happens if we choose an Hamperian loop that looks like this. For simplicity, let's just say that we're going to call this distance D, and let me give this, call this distance L. And now up here we have B this way, down here we have B that way. So if we think of that loop, and I choose that loop because it is made up of segments where the line is along B, which would be the top and the bottom, and perpendicular to B. So that means the dot product is easy to figure out either way. So let's see what we can get out of that. Let's suppose that I started this discussion out thinking of it as finite wires, but we could imagine that this is just sort of a flat plane of copper with a current coming along. That would be sort of the continuous limit instead of the wires. So we can imagine that there is, that the current that's being carried is equal to some current density times L, where L is this distance. So if I have this sort of flat sheet of current coming at me, I basically want, and it has a current density, I can get the amount of current by just taking the current density multiplied by the length, the perpendicular length of that sheet that I can take on, okay? There'll be an infinite current because the sheet's infinite in either way, but I can talk about a current density and the amount of current through a certain length. So if we think of it that way, then let's look at Ampere's law. The integral around our Hamperian loop of B dot BL . This piece, B dot DL, is zero. This piece, B dot DL, is zero. This piece, let's say I walk along this way. So my DLs are like that. Here, the DLs are all along B, so B dot DL becomes B times DL. By the symmetry of this problem, this B is all, this is all of one distance from this sheet, so B will have to be constant. By the symmetry up here, we know it's to the left, so it's along that line. So the integral of B dot DL becomes B times the integral of DL. So this becomes B times L. Similarly, this is B times L. So this whole integral becomes 2B times L. Or that's the magnitude of B. That's equal to mu 0 times I enclosed, which is going to be mu 0 times j times l, where j is the current density for the sheet. Okay? So that allows us to solve for the magnitude of the magnetic field. The L's cancel out, which is good, so it's very similar to the cylindrical problems in Gauss's, in Gaussian surfaces where you don't know what the length is, but you have to calculate the volumes, they have to invent a length, and lo and behold, it cancels out when you do this problem correct. So you sort of have the same thing here. So the L's on each side here cancel, so we have B is equal to mu 0 J over 2. And you'll note that it has no dependence on D at all. So, in the same way that if you have an infinite charge sheet, you have an electric field to each side that's uniform and goes out forever with the same strength. Here we have this infinite current sheet, and we have a magnetic field that is going to one direction on the top and one direction on the bottom. And it's uniform forever, all the way up and all the way down. Which again, just like the electrostatics piece, doesn't make any sense, except you have to remember we started out with a nonsensical physical situation, which is an infinite current sheet to begin with. So you shouldn't be as bothered by this strange infinity as you would be otherwise. Okay? So it's very, very similar to what we have. Alright, so you could imagine doing something very similar to what we did with capacitive plates and take a current sheet and a current sheet with the currents going in opposite directions, and you can create a region of magnetic field that's uniform going, you know, in one direction perpendicular to the current. But there turns out to be something that's a lot simpler to make, which is sort of more useful for magnetism. And that would be to imagine this whole geometry, but instead of looking at it in a planar way, let's take the plane and sort of fold it in on itself. So let's imagine that we have a geometry where I have a current coming in. How many of you know what a slinky is? Yeah? So this is a slinky. If you know what a slinky is, then you can probably visualize what I'm trying to draw here. But it was once decided that calling this a slinky was not professional. So instead, we call it a solenoid. And so a solenoid is meant to be something that looks a lot like a spring. And you will have a current that goes through it that circulates around down the spring. And you will have some characteristics in this thing, but the main one being is how many loops per centimeter do you have? That is, how tightly packed are the slinky layers. Okay. And so the simplest system is one where you have an infinite slinky. Okay. You may have wanted one of those when you were a kid, but I don't think they actually make them. However, we're going to assume that we have an infinite solenoid. And we're going to have a current that comes in one end here and goes out the other end there. So it has a it has a hand in this, right? So in the way that I've tried to draw this, what's happening is the current is coming in, and at the top it comes toward you, circles around, and at the bottom it's going into the board, comes back around, circles toward you, and goes into the board, etc. So it keeps doing that. Alright, so think of this as a very long, rigid slinky or spring. You okay with that? Alright, so now imagine what would happen if we were to take this thing and sort of put a plane right through the middle of it and look at what we would see in that plane. Then what you might imagine you would see is coming out at you, you would see lots of currents at the top coming out at you, and at the bottom you would see a lot of currents of the same magnitude going in. Okay, so I hold the slinky like this, I sort of slice it right down the middle. You imagine it still functions anyway. We just sort of look at a sort of an X-ray slice right through the middle of it. And on the top, each of the wires has a current coming out at you. And on the bottom, each of the wires has a current going in. Okay? So within that plane, what you'll notice is that it exhibits the symmetry that we have up here. If we just consider the top wires, for example, the top wires do exactly this in that particular plane. The bottom wires will do exactly this, except the directions of the B field will be opposite. So if we imagine that instead of coming out at you, the current is going in, then it's going to circulate like this, which means on top of that layer, the B field will be going to the right, and on the bottom, the B field will be going to the left. So it'll be the opposite of what we see there. So if for the moment we forget the rest of the world and only consider what's in this plane, then just like what we had up above, the top layer will give us a B this way, and a B this way, and the bottom layer is going into the board, so we'll have a B above it going to the right, and a B below it going to the left. If we were to imagine that the top and the bottom are each current sheets, which is sort of what it looks like in that plane, then what you'll notice is, remember, this B, if the density of wires here is the same as the density here, which it has to be because every one of them circles around, this B is equal in magnitude to the B's here, and that one is also here. Remember, for this top thing, this B is true all the way up and all the way down. For the bottom one, it's true all the way up and all the way down. And they're both vector fields, which means the field at any point is this vector superposition of the individual field. So you can now ask what happens when we take each of these things and add them together. Up here, we have a B due to the top that's going to the left, and a B due to the bottom that's going to the right. The distance doesn't matter because the field stays the same all the way out. So they cancel. There's no field out here. Similarly, for the bottom, you get a field that goes to the right, and the bottom one gives you a field that goes to the left. And so the field here and the field here cancel out when you go down here. in the middle, you see that the red field from the top and the pink field from the bottom add together. So what happens in this plane is these cancel out down here, and you confine the magnetic field to being right in the middle. And we rotate it about the axis of the solenoid. What you have is in every possible plane, you have this whole thing happening, which means on the inside of the solenoid, you have a magnetic field that's uniform, that goes all the way down, and on the outside of the solenoid, you have no magnetic field at all. So it's very similar to this capacitor where you have an electric field between but nothing outside. Now we have this infinite sort of spring, and inside we can have a uniform and no magnetic field, and outside we have nothing. So if we look at that geometry for a moment, let's imagine that we have a solenoid. Let's say we have radius R, and let's say that we have n turns per unit length. Then if we create a magnetic field, an Amperian loop, for example, that looks like this, then I enclosed is going to be equal to the length of the loop times the current that's in all the wires times the number of turns per unit length that we have. That's all. So if we were to consider that Amperian loop, then the integral of B dot dl up at the top, we have no magnetic field at all, so there's no B dot dl. By the symmetry, the magnetic field on the inside here is all going this way. So that means there's no contribution from this and there's no contribution from that. So in this Amperian loop, and it won't matter where we are along here, it's just going to be B times this length L. And that's going to be equal to mu zero times the current that's enclosed, which is going to be L times I times N. For the magnetic field magnitude that's in a loop, in a solenoid, is equal to mu zero times I times N. Outside B is equal to zero, and then if you're looking at the solenoid and you want to know what's the direction of B, then you do your little right-hand rule, because it'd be the same direction you get if you're thinking of only a single input wire and you look at the rotation current on there. So in this case, if I were doing it, you can see that up above the currents are coming out at you, down below they're going in, so I would grab it like this, and my thumb would give me the direction of the B field inside. So that solenoid would have the B field going to the right. And it would be a uniform magnitude inside equal to that magnitude, and it would be zero outside. Okay? All right. Tough day. So let's spice it up a little bit. Can any of you tell me the difference between what it is to seduce and what it is to induce? Oh, come on, I'm a science geek and I do that. I mean, without getting too much detail, what does it mean if you seduce something? I don't even want to know what. Okay, say you induce something, what do you mean?
It's like the insight creates, if you like infuse a charge, you make a charge.
If you induce it, you make it. You cause it to happen. Right? If you seduce, are you causing it to happen? It's a little more subtle than that. You're sort of creating a compelling case for it to happen on its own, sort of thing. A seduction is like a nice invitation. I think. What do I know? Do you see the difference? If I induce you to do something, it's a little less nice than if I seduce you to do something. Seduce has a little bit of velvet around it. Okay? It may be the same thing in the end, but it's different. Alright. So, we're not very nice in physics. So we're not going to talk about seduction, but we are going to talk about induction. Oops. And induction is quite simply one of the most fabulous discoveries humans have ever made. I don't think I'm going to completely make that case for you today, but within a week, every one of you is going to agree with me that that's true. I can almost guarantee you that. Alright, so what does it mean? When we talk about induction, it is the statement that a changing magnetic field induces an EMF. So what does that mean? What does an EMF do? An EMF is like a battery, right? So if I have a loop of wire and I insert an EMF like a battery, it will cause current flow. Okay? What I have here is a wire loop. Amplified it by putting lots of loops together. But it's just a wire loop. I connected the ends of that loop to a voltmeter. Okay? There's no battery on this. There's no generator. It is not plugged into the wall. Alright, it is just a loop of wire. Behold, a simple battery, a simple magnet. Lest you doubt my word. Okay, magnet. Observe. Not to be confused with seduction. Okay. I'm creating an EMF in this loop when I do that. Okay? Notice there's no, in principle, there's no magnetic field here, or it is a constant one due to the earth or whatever. This has a strong magnetic field. As it goes into this, I have a big changing magnetic field in this region. And you can see it induces an EMF. And notice that if I change it the other direction, the EMF is induced in the other direction. Okay? Alright? If I were to have a changing electric field, a current flows. If it's a changing electric field, the current will change. You okay? If I have a wire, all right? If I take this magnetic field and I change it through this loop, it induces this EMF that you see is actually changing. If I do this slowly, it doesn't, it's not much. If I stop, it stops. If I go fast, you get a big one. So as I have a changing magnetic field, I am creating an induced EMF. The induced EMF basically is creating an electric field in the wire. That's what you sort of mean when you talk about an induced EMF or an EMF. If I put a battery in a wire, one way to think about it is you have a potential difference, and the potential difference times distance is electric field. That's why the charges are moving in the wires, because you're creating an electric field in the wire, okay? So, when I take this, I create a changing electric field in the wire. If I have a changing electric field in the wire, it's creating changing currents that are creating changing magnetic fields. If I have changing magnetic fields, I'm creating changing electric fields. If I have a handful of charge and I do this, I create a changing electric field in space, which will create a changing magnetic field. This shows us a changing magnetic field gives you a changing electric field. These two things are coupled together. So if I do this, I'm changing an electric field, which induces a magnetic field, which induces an electric field. This whole thing propagates out. And when we study it, we'll figure out that this whole thing's phenomenon propagates out at the speed of light. Because it is light. That, my young ones, is the essence of life. Okay, now, is that cool or what? Alright? So that's where we're headed. It's going to take us about a week to get there. But it is totally cool. And it is, in my opinion, perhaps the most influential and beautiful thing that has been ever discovered or created by man. I mean, it's amazing stuff. So, this is called induction. If this is induction, What we have is a magnetic field here. This thing just carries magnetic field, so I can create it. But we can do it other ways. I have here a loop. Okay, this loop is connected to a battery, and we know that if I run a current around this loop, it should create a magnetic field. Okay? If I change the current in this loop, it's going to create a changing magnetic field through this other loop, and it should induce a voltage. So if I just place the loop on top of this other one, okay, see that there's no voltage in the bottom loop. But look at what happens if I now put the top loop across an EMF. The moment I put it across the EMF, I have a massive changing magnetic field in the top loop, which means there's one in the bottom loop as well. Changing because it starts out at zero, and then I start shoving a bunch of current through there, and I get a big magnetic field all of a sudden. When I have a changing magnetic field, I get an induced EMF down below. As soon as I reach equilibrium and I have a constant current, I have a magnetic field, but it's not changing. And when it is not changing, you'll see that this thing goes back to zero. It then jumps again, other direction, when I cut the current off. So watch. I turn the current on, I get an EMF, it goes back to zero, the current is still on, I now take the current off, it goes the other direction, and then goes back to zero once the magnetic field settles down. Okay? Any questions? Comments? Okay, so this fun is brought to you by a guy named Michael Faraday, who also happened to invent the Bunsen burner. I don't know why we don't call it a Faraday burner if he invented it, but whatever. How many of you have induction stoves at home? Do you know what I'm talking about? Okay. I mean, I don't know why, but I was thinking of Bunsen burner. It turns out you can use induction to heat things up, too. So they're cool stoves because basically you're just using electromagnetic stuff, and you can put your hand on it. It's not hot, but it can generate heat in the pan. So it's sort of cool. Never mind. If you have one, you'll think it's cool. Never seen one. Get a friend who has one. All right. So if we have a magnetostatic situation, let me just remind you, if you sort of imagine a loop, then remember that we have Kirchhoff's law, which basically says as you go around the loop, the sum of the voltage dips and rises is equal to zero. This is around a closed loop. We can imagine that the electric field goes as minus, well, we know that it goes as the negative derivative of the potential with respect to distance, and E dot dl then goes as V. So what this tells us, if we are thinking of a circuit where we have Kirchhoff's law happening and we don't have changing fields, we have just constant currents, then what we get is that the magnitude of E dot dl is equal to zero as we go around the loop. So that is really just a restatement of Kirchhoff's loop law. It's telling us as I go around the loop from one point back to that same point, that the change in potential is zero. And if I run across things like resistors and batteries and stuff, I'll have the same voltage rises, I have drops as I go around, so I come back to the same value. Okay? You good with that? So I sort of put it in a different language. If we live in a world where we have changing fields, what we just showed is that that actually can't be true here if we have a changing magnetic field. Because what it tells us is it has an induced EMF. That means if I go around this loop, there'll be a non-zero voltage gain. So generally, we give the symbol epsilon, and we call it the induced EMF. But you can think of it sort of as the voltage sum you'd have as you go around that loop. This is around a closed loop of E dot dl. So this, you can imagine, is just like we did with Ampere's law of B dot dl. So physically, you think of the same thing, except now we're summing E dot dl as you go around. And Faraday's law of induction is that as you go around that loop, the EMF is minus the rate of change of the magnetic flux through that loop, which is a way of quantifying what I mean when I said changing magnetic field in that region of space. Remember, electric flux is the electric field dotted dA, sort of. So imagine we have a loop. It will have an area, have a dA. So you take the magnetic field dotted in the dA, gives you the magnetic flux going through the loop, and then it has to be changing. We saw that it doesn't happen if the field is constant, but you get an induced EMF if the field is changing. So we sum up the magnetic flux, and we take the derivative of it, which is the measure of the change, rate of change of the magnetic flux. All right, and then there's this minus sign, which we'll talk about as we go. But basically, this is what you just saw. If I have a loop and I change the magnetic flux through it, I get an EMF. Okay? Now, one of the things that's sort of cool is that what we just see is that that certainly is true if it's in wires. There is nothing in that that says you have to have a wire. It turns out that it is true in space in general. Okay? So it's true in wires, it's true in free space, and it's true in materials other than a copper wire. Okay? Now, if you want to look at this, in a sense, the magnitude is driven by the flux, that is, how much of a magnetic field I have and how fast it's changing. So if I go slowly, I get a small EMF. If I go fast, I get a big one. All of that is quite quantifiable. All right, and so we'll look at that. Because you know, for example, how to calculate the magnetic field at the center of a loop. And I can change that by changing the current. So I can calculate that. So I can change, I can get the magnetic flux. So that gives me the magnitude. So then the question is, how do we think about the direction? And there's sort of a rule of thumb. Well, there's a rule that we use to quantify the direction. And you get the direction from considering Lenz's law, we call it. Lenz's law tells us that the induced EMF, or if you want, you can think of that as being the induced current, if you're thinking about a current being induced by the EMF, and sometimes that's best to visualize, and sometimes in problems it's specifically done that way. So, the induced EMF opposes the change that produces it. So this is one of those things that makes a whole lot of sense after we look at a few examples, but may not make a lot of sense quite yet. So let's look at this. Let us suppose that we have a region of a uniform magnetic field in space. Which is all going into the board. And now let me suppose that I have current. I have a wire loop. Which looks like this. And it is being pulled out of the region of magnetic field with a velocity V. And let's say that this loop has a resistance R. And we're going to say this distance, I'll call little L. What is physically going to happen here? Is there a magnetic flux through that wire loop? There's a magnetic field that's penetrating through that wire loop. There'll be a flux. Is it changing? The field is not changing. But the flux, which is the field times the area of the loop, is changing because as I pull the loop out, there's less and less loop area that has the field going. So the total field penetrating through that loop is changing. So this will, according to Lenz's law, give us an EMF in the loop, which will cause a current to flow. So then the question is, what direction will the current flow? Lenz's law tells us the induced EMF, i.e. the current, will flow in a direction that opposes the change that produced it. So the way to think about this is, I have a current loop. As I pull it out, I am reducing the magnetic field that is going through that current loop. Therefore, I will create a current that will go in a direction so as to increase the field that is going through the middle of the loop. Which means the field is going into the board. I am reducing that, which means I want the current in the loop to go in a direction that will give me a field in the middle of the loop going into the board, which by my right-hand rule means it's going to go that way. So the current is going to rotate that way. That's how you get the direction. That's how you think your way through Lenz's law. quantitatively, the EMF is equal to minus d phi m over dt. That's minus d. I should specify something here. Let's call this distance x. So the velocity is equal to dx over dt. It's changing. The flux at any given time is going to be the magnetic field times the area of the loop in the region of the magnetic field. It has a sort of a wall there. So that'd be B times L times X with respect to time. So that'll be minus B and L that are constant. Dx over dt is basically V. So this is minus BLV. EMF is equal to I times R. This thing has a resistance R, so E is equal to IR. So the magnitude of the current I is equal to EMF divided by R, which is equal to BLV divided by R. The minus sign sort of contains within it the information that we call Lenz's law, but I use it, I ignore the minus sign and then use Lenz's law and figure out the direction. And in the end, that's really what the minus sign is giving you. It's a little bit like the springs. If you write down very formally the spring equation, if you recall, it goes as something like the vector x is, you know, k times x minus x naught vector. There's a minus sign there. If you're doing a mechanics problem with springs and you just want to do pattern recognition and fit an equation in and you pop that minus sign in without thinking about it, good luck. It just is a mess. What the minus sign is really telling you is that this is a restoring force in the spring. If I extend the spring, it's pulling back. If I push it in, it's pushing out. So when you look at the problem, you think about what the spring is doing, and you put the force in with the appropriate direction. That is the minus sign. That's what you're doing. So you don't then throw in a minus sign on top of it. Lenz's law is sort of the same way. The magnitude of the EMF, and then, in this case, you get to the current, by just looking at how the flux is changing. Okay? And you calculate this d phi m dt, and that will give you the magnitude of the EMF. Then to figure out what the direction of the EMF, or the direction of the current is, don't worry about that minus sign. Go to Lenz's law and think your way through it. Always back to Lenz's law. The induced EMF or current opposes the change that produced it. And we'll do a bunch of those, so hopefully you'll begin to get the hang of that. What I mean by that, but that's what the minus sign really is all about. Don't get too strung out about it. Let me give you a little bit of practice on that. So let's suppose I have a current loop here, and I have I increasing, and I have a current loop out there. What will be the direction of the induced current in the second loop? Think about that one for a moment, because I want you to commit. I in the one loop is increasing, and I need you to decide whether I is going to be in the other loop is going to go clockwise or counterclockwise in response. side, clockwise, counterclockwise. All who say clockwise, raise your hand. Oh, everybody's looking around. Counterclockwise. Okay. Correcting for looking around is probably a 50-50 split. Alright, so here's how to think through it. Consider the left-hand loop. I is going this way, which means that the magnetic field on the inside of that loop is coming out, which means on the outside of the loop it's going in. So the magnetic field due to the left-hand loop in the right-hand loop is going into the board. Okay? I is increasing, so that field is getting stronger. So there is a field in the middle of the right-hand loop that is getting stronger and going inside. If it's getting stronger, the flux through that loop is changing, and the EMF will be induced in a direction that opposes the change that produces it. If the field is getting stronger going in, then the current that is induced will want to force it to be weaker. So there will be an induced current that will go this way, so that the field on the inside of the loop due to the induced current is coming out, which is fighting the growing field going in. See how easy that is? Honest, it's not bad, and you'll get used to it, but it is that convoluted. You have to know the direction of the field in the left hand, and is it going, is it getting stronger or weaker? What is it doing over here? Is it getting stronger or weaker? And then what direction do I have to make the current go to oppose that change, whatever it is? That's the thinking you go through in all these. All right? Circuits are made up of loops of wire. You actually use Kirchhoff's law to do so. So you can imagine that if I have a changing current somewhere, I'll have a changing field, which is going to then cause induction in some other part of the circuit. And that's going to affect the current in that part of the circuit. So life can be sort of complicated. So, just like we took the resistance that is inside a circuit and we sort of compressed it into regions that we call resistors and we sort of ignore it in the rest of the circuit, we tend to condense the inductive sensitivity of a circuit into small regions and we call them inductors. And you can picture them as little infinite solenoids, okay? So let's ponder that for a moment. This solenoid is also something where it's a bit of a laboratory for inductance, because if I change the current in this solenoid, it is also going to be changing the flux going through the solenoid, which will cause an induced current. So it gets a bit confusing. I can maybe make it seem a little simpler if I imagine having a solenoid like that and I put a wire loop on the axis of the solenoid. If I now change the current in the solenoid, it will change the magnetic field that is penetrating through that loop, which will then induce a current in the loop. Okay? So if you want to think of it that way. But it also will affect itself. So a couple of things. This idea of a solenoid, we actually give it the name inductor. Just like we have capacitors and resistors in circuits, we have things you can sort of think of as little springs or little solenoids, and we call them inductors because they're very sensitive to these sorts of weird things with magnetic flux. So what I'd like to think of at the moment is sort of an inductor and how it talks to itself. So let's think of this as an inductor without a Dave. Okay? And we have a current going through here. The magnetic flux that goes through the solenoid is going to be proportional to that current. The magnetic flux is equal to the magnetic field times the area of that solenoid, cross-sectional area. Magnetic flux is equal to B, but for a solenoid we know that's mu 0 times N times I times the area. Which is another way of saying, I mean, basically that's just a proof that the magnetic flux is proportional to I. Let's suppose that the length of this solenoid is equal to L, the number of loops that we have for this particular solenoid then is going to be equal to the number of loops per unit length times the length. So that means that phi M for length L is going to be equal to mu 0 times N times I times A times N L. So where am I getting that? This is the magnetic flux if I consider only a single loop, because I have just that one area. This piece where I have this N in here, that really is what gives me the strength of the magnetic field. If it penetrates only one loop, then the flux that I get there is only that field times the area of one of those loops. If in fact I'm asking for all of these different loops, then there are N times L of them, and the magnetic flux becomes the flux through one loop here times the total loops. So this would be for a single loop. So phi M for a length L is equal to mu 0 times N squared times A times L times I. So we started out looking at what the flux is for a single loop. We say, what is it for N loop, for a length of loops? And we find that that flux is proportional to I, okay? And there's this constant. That constant depends on the area. It depends on the length you're choosing. It depends on the number of loops per unit length. But all of those are geometrical quantities. So just like the capacitance of a capacitor depended only on the geometry of that capacitor, here, the degree of which this flux depends on the current is proportional to something that involves only the geometry. This depends only on that solenoid, and we give it a constant. It'll be different for different solenoids because they'll have different numbers of loops per unit length, have different areas, etc. We give this a symbol L, and we call it the constant of self-inductance. So if I have a solenoid and I'm changing the current, then I am changing the magnetic flux, and there will be an induced EMF within itself. Okay, and that will cause lots of hassle, so we'll talk about what that does. But the degree to which that happens is proportional to the geometry of this thing, which is what we quantify with self-inductance. So if I look at di over dt, that's d phi m over dt, if you want to think of it that way. That gives us a d phi m. A changing current gives us a changing magnetic flux, which gives us an induced EMF. So if we consider a solenoid, the induced EMF, which we've defined to be minus d phi m over dt, is equal to minus L di over dt. Phi m is L times I. D phi m over dt is going to be L times di dt. So the induced EMF in a solenoid depends on the changing current in that solenoid and its constant self-inductance, which is a geometrical factor that describes the solenoid itself. If I put a little solenoid that we call inductor in a circuit, and I have a changing current in that circuit, it will induce an EMF across that circuit element that's that size. So that all of a sudden gives us another term in trying to figure out how to solve what's going on in the circuits. And this time it's not proportional to the current or the charge, it's proportional to the change in current. Okay. So that's what happens if you don't have a date. You can imagine having a situation where you get a date and you have one inductor talking to another inductor. So this would be like what we did over here, where we have a current loop that talks to a different current loop. What we'll find at the start of class next time is if I have a changing current here in number one, it will change the magnetic field that's produced by that loop. Okay? That changing magnetic field will change the field flux going through this loop, which will then induce an EMF and a current over here. And what we'll find is, again, that is going to depend only on the geometry of this situation. That is, number of loops in area here, number of loops in area here, the relative positioning and everything of them. And there'll be a constant that will tell us for a certain change here, how big the change is here. And now it's going to be called the constant of mutual inductance instead of self-inductance, because here you've got one talking to the other instead of one just talking to itself. Okay, so have a great